this smells a little bit like some kind of a pre-invasion force.
We have a real problem at the moment, which is the anti-war movement in Europe as a very nasty vein of anti-Americanism.
Total devastation will be the answer. The answer to mass murder.
You can't be down here doing that. You have to leave.
Yeah?
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Thursday, October 24th. I'm Verna Avery Brown. U.S. troops have already begun amassing in the Gulf region as the Pentagon moves ahead with plans for an attack against Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. According to an article in today's Guardian in the U.K., the Pentagon may be forced, however, to rethink its invasion timetable, thanks to certain members of the U.N. Security Council, which have put a crimp in their plans. Jim Paul, director of the Global Policy Institute, says France, Russia, and China object to the language in the U.S. resolution and refuse to bring it forward for a vote in the General Council. That leaves the threat of a veto and the U.S. scrambling for a way around it.
The U.S. and the U.K. decided after negotiating for a number of weeks with their other permanent partners to decide to go right ahead and bring it into the rest of the council members and hope that in that way they can actually move it along to adoption and move around the threatened veto by getting enough support from the non-permanent members.
So they're trying to circumvent the Security Council members where they have very little support.
Well, they're trying to circumvent the permanent members, France and Russia in particular, that have said that they just won't go along with the resolution as it stands.
So does the protocol allow for that? I mean, can they actually circumvent France and Russia and end up getting their resolution passed by going beyond the permanent members of the General Security Council?
There's nothing preventing any member of the Security Council to table a resolution in the Council. And then it's up to the other council members to decide when it comes to a vote whether it's going to be voted on favorably. They need to have 9 out of the 15 members need to vote for it. And there, of course, can be no vetoes. So the United States obviously has been talking intensively with the non-permanent members, the elected members, as we like to call them, of the council, to rally support. And there are different theories about whether they have lined up the 7 votes that they need to get have the resolution passed.
But this is also the same administration that has said it would move forward unilaterally without any kind of backing from the UN.
Well, that's certainly true, and there's no question they would do that if they didn't get a resolution. On the other hand, this resolution helps them gain support internationally and helps them to make it seem like this isn't entirely unilateral action. And so even though the superpower can do what it wants, still in all, there's some very strong advantages to doing it this way.
So what are the main sticking points for France and Russia within the permanent Security Council members?
There are slight differences between the three, and particularly between Russia and France, on details. But it comes down to 2 things, I think. One is the way in which there is some sort of a tripwire towards war in here. And the French have been especially adamant about what they call the 2-resolution approach. That is, that there's 1 resolution that sets forth the inspections process, and the second, and that the if there's any violation by Iraq of the rules laid down by the first resolution, that then the council would remain the ultimate arbiter of whether of what kind of reaction should be taken by the international community, and whether it would be war or some other thing to force the Iraqis to comply. Then there's the matter of the different operative paragraphs in the resolution that talk about inspections and how the inspections would go forward. And there's a pretty strong feeling by the French and the Russians that there are, in the resolution, unacceptable demands that could not be met by Iraq or would not be met by Iraq that would lead to Iraqi rejection of the resolution.
Like what?
And then directly to war.
For example?
Well, there's really quite a few elements here. One of them is the extent to which troops would be stationed in Iraq. So, the resolution says that there would be stationed in Iraq to protect the inspectors, but there's generally a sense that this smells a little bit like some kind of a pre-invasion force. There were early estimates that the force that was being considered might be as high as 50,000 troops, that those troops might be provided by the United States and the United Kingdom to the UN, and that that was something that Iraqis wouldn't find acceptable. Another one is that the UNMAVIC and IAEA, as the resolution draft puts it, shall have the right to declare for the purposes of freezing a site to be inspected no fly, no drive zones, exclusion zones, and or ground and air transit corridors, which shall be enforced by UN security forces or by member states. Well, this is a pretty sweeping thing. They already, U.S. and U.K. already have these no-fly zones, but this seems to extend no-fly to possibly any area of Iraq. Also, no-drive, exclusion zones, whatever exactly that means. So this is a pretty problematical thing, and it doesn't seem to be directly related to the needs of good inspection. And so the French have been saying, let's look at what is really required for good inspection. Let's not put all these hyper-political things in here that could easily lead to a provocation and determination by the United States that that a material breach had been made. So
and Russia, they pretty much agree with France on this?
Yeah, I mean, this is more or less the position of both of them.
And what about China?
Well, China has not taken quite a... China's diplomacy in general is a little bit more low-key than Russia and France. They kind of hate to have a big split with the United States. They have all kinds of things going on with the U.S. Of course, Russia and France do as well, but they seem a little bit more confident to be making demands here. I think also we have to recognize that Russia and France have a much bigger stake in the oil dimension of this thing, and that that's also partly driving their opposition to the U.S.
Well, what do you mean?
Well,
what's their stake?
They have very big oil companies that have made deals with the present Iraqi government.
Mm, I see.
Estimated between $1 and $2 trillion worth of oil deals. That's an awful lot of money. And they really are rather reluctant to see Saddam Hussein overthrown mm-hmm. and a U.S. military government come in there, because then it's almost sure that the U.S. military government would turn over the very best oil fields to U.S. companies and U.K. companies, and the French and the Russians would be left out.
So they have a vested economic interest in this equation that sort of makes their position seem a lot less noble or moral-based. So now what about, we're reading reports today where U.S. troops have already begun amassing in the region. I would imagine that this would be, if the UN does not pass this resolution in a timely fashion, that might become problematic for the U.S. with these troops amassing in the region already.
Well, I think it's to be expected that given their commitment to the war outcome, that they're going to start deploying forces there because they have a timetable. They want to have a war during a particular a weather window, which is in the sort of period December, January, February, as I understand it, when the desert temperatures are lower. And this is what happened, in, of course, in 1991 as well, when after the bombing in that began in January, then the ground troops went in. So that's apparently when they're thinking of having their war, and they have to. It takes a couple of months to get all the forces in place. So that's why the Pentagon is going ahead with this. And that's a good signal to us that willy-nilly they're going to have their war, and with or without the UN, with or without inspections. And if inspections go in and they don't find anything, well, the U.S. is going to make sure that there's going to be a war anyway.
Jim Paul is director of the Global Policy Institute. Throughout the history of the political social movement in this country, student activism has played a critical role. But where are the students in the days leading up to the attack on Iraq? Where are the sit-ins, the teach-ins, the takeovers of the 60s? Where have all the flowers gone? Well, they're mobilizing, we're happy to announce, in large numbers on campuses everywhere. Sachin Aman of Boston University, Josh Healy of the University of Wisconsin at Madison, and Peta Lindsay of Howard University are in the forefront of the student activism movement around this impending war. We spoke with them earlier today about the agenda opposing the war. Peta Lindsay is a freshman, again, at Howard University in D.C.
I'm a freshman at Howard University, and at Howard University, of course, we've been doing a lot. The administration has yet to recognize us as an official organization. They have some problems with our, you know, charter and everything that we submitted, but that'll be dealt with later. So we've been organizing mostly underground and with the help of other student groups on campus, like the Muslim Students Association, which is a recognized organization and is also part of the Answer Coalition. Around the country, it's been going incredibly well for mobilizing for the 26th. The thing is that Answer has been holding demonstrations against the war, against racism, and defense of civil rights and civil liberties over the past year, and most of the demonstrations have been made up, like, almost entirely of students. But with this demonstration, the students are really taking the initiative. The students are really the organizers of the demonstration and really organizing to get their peers out here for the 26th. For example, Penn State University students have told us they're bringing 500 people. Burlington, Vermont told us they're bringing 400. We have three buses from Kansas City University. SLAM, which is the Student Liberation Action Movement, a part of the CUNY system, is bringing six buses and five vans. And it's not just college students either. For example, in Yellow Springs, Ohio, there's a high school senior who, as a senior project, is bringing a busload of high school students and documenting the entire event. And it's just really been amazing for us, overwhelming the kinds of, you know, we get flooded with emails and calls of students who want to organize, not just for the 26th, but for a continuing movement.
Mm. Okay, and so we also have Josh Healy on the line with us, who is a freshman at the University of Wisconsin in Madison.
Yeah, we're definitely mobilizing on two fronts. One, we're organizing two busloads of people to come down to Washington for the anti-war march on Saturday the 26th. And we have people, since we are kind of the only people organizing from the Wisconsin state area, we have people coming from all over the state to Madison to catch these buses, and also people from Minnesota and Iowa, who this was the closest bus they could get. So we're taking people from various Midwest states to D.C., and at the same time, on Saturday, the people who are not going to D.C. were having a big rally at our state capitol here in Madison at noon on Saturday to be in solidarity with the large anti-war protest. And this has been really a statewide mobilization of groups coming together and to do this rally on Saturday.
Sachin Aman is also on the line with us. Sachin, you are a freshman at Boston University, and I'm impressed with all these freshmen who are involved in this activity as well. Sachin, what can you tell us about Boston University's campus and what you're organizing? How are you mobilizing there?
Basically, there will be students who are working with Students United for Peace. Many of them are going down to D.C. with Answer on buses. I know there will be many buses leaving from Boston taking kids from all over the colleges to Washington, D.C. I myself will be going down, but will not be going with Answer. I'll be traveling down there by myself, but I know there will be about 10 students, from Students United for Peace from Boston who are going. I don't know what other groups are also going, but I'll be going representing Boston Mobilization, the community group, instead. And we've been doing a lot of mobilizing for another event, which will be on November 3rd at 1 p.m. on the Boston Commons, which will be a New England-wide event, which we're expecting 10,000 to 15,000 people to attend. That's been the biggest thing we've been trying to mobilize.
Mm. Student activism has played a major role in the anti-war movements throughout history. Just to name a few, we have the examples of Columbia University, Indiana University, North Carolina A&T, and of course the standoff at Kent State University during the anti-Vietnam War protest. I'm curious, it sounds like activism is alive on your campuses, but are you encountering any apathy around this issue? Is it difficult to interest students in being politically active against this particular war, impending war against Iraq? Peta, you want to start?
Yeah, I got to tell you that the only difficulty I'm encountering is from the administration. The students themselves, I mean, in this being a historically black university and a historically active university, are very much into protesting, are very much into the idea of reclaiming their civil rights once they've been taken away. Again, you understand, with the signing of the USA Patriot Act. And so they really want to come out for this demonstration. We've been having these amazing outreach sessions, but the university itself is making it difficult for us to meet, you know, not letting us post our flyers and whatnot.
And have they stated why?
No, it's been kind of bureaucratic issues in terms of, you know, they claim I'm not talking to the right people or something like that. They have these things that, well, when I went to the student activities office, what the president said to me was, Howard University is an exclusive university, and we'd like to take opportunities like this to remind you of how exclusive it is.
And what did you interpret that to mean?
I don't, it was hostile. That's how I interpreted.
Now, Josh, you are the grandson of Dorothy Healy, who is a programmer at WPFW, but is a longtime activist in the movement with Pacifica. How much of an influence has that had on your life?
Well, I mean, I've grown up in a history of anti-war activism and social justice activism, so that's played a role definitely in shaping my beliefs and my actions. But, I mean, here on campus, I've met a lot of people, and most people who don't have that history and who are getting involved for the first time. Like Peta was saying, a lot of people, like, understand what's going on. A lot of people don't want to see a war in Iraq. You were asking about apathy. There's definitely some apathy. People are like, people say, well, what does this have to do with us? People don't want to question so much Bush, especially post-September 11th, but more and more students are coming again to the realization that if we don't stand up, if we don't tell Bush, no, this war is not okay, it's not what we want, it's not going to bring peace, then no one is. No one's going to stand up to him. So more people are beginning to question and are beginning to stand up for their rights.
So are students today, Sachin, on your campus, would you consider them to be generally as socially and politically conscious as perhaps their parents or grandparents were? Are there sit-ins? Are there teach-ins? Are there takeovers?
Basically here we have, you know, a bunch of events going on, but just like Pedro said, we have administrative bureaucracy where Students United for Peace actually is not recognized by the Student Activities Office either. So we have a lot of trouble putting up signs and stuff like that. But I see a little bit of apathy on campus. So you see in the student newspaper and stuff like that, not people who are exactly against the anti-war movement, but they're more against, like, what can we do about it? You know, they feel like they're powerless in the movement. But, being in Boston with so many colleges around, I'm really motivated because I work with Boston Mobilization, and it lets me see that so many students around Boston are really motivated to do things. So aside from Boston University, you can definitely tell that Boston has a huge anti-war movement going on. But within BU itself, because of the administrative bureaucracy, it's kind of hard to get students motivated because we can't post signs everywhere. We can't, you know, sponsor our events all the time.
How can you determine that there is a growing, burgeoning anti-war movement there at Boston U if you're unable to post signs and posters and things like that?
Because we have Boston Mobilization mobilizes students from all over Boston through different colleges, and we have events like this past Sunday. We had a Walk for Peace in Boston. We attracted hundreds of people to come, and many from Boston University I had never even met before expressed interest in the anti-war movement. So we see kids coming from all colleges, including Boston University, so I know it's not a completely apathetic campus. It's basically kids do not get the word out enough because we can't put up signs everywhere.
Here at UW, at Wisconsin-Madison, one sign that you can tell that more people or want to learn more or becoming more active is that the anti-war group that I'm a part of is now not the only group that is doing stuff about Iraq. Just last night there was a teach-in put on by the National Lawyers Guild about the war in Iraq and how it's against international law and other issues. And so lots of different groups are coming together to realize this is an issue that affects all of us.
Go right ahead. A factor that really is in the minds of students on college campuses today, Peta Lindsay.
It's pretty clear for students that if there is in fact a war declared, those who will be declaring the war will not be the ones that are fighting it, that it's going to be us. It's going to be youth of color. It's going to be poor working class youth. They're going to have to go overseas and fight and die in this rich man's war, which is obviously a war for oil, which is something that all of the students seem to be aware of. But the other interesting thing is that the casualties that we're really feeling from this war right now are cuts to our education. In the Hilltop, which is the Howard University newspaper, they recently ran an article about how the Pell Grant, which is a need-based form of financial aid, will be cut to fund the war. It was a very, very interesting article to have been run, and it's the kind of thing that's causing a massive backlash amongst the student population. I mean, it's causing them to get political because they understand that they need that kind of thing to, you know, proceed with their education, to proceed with their lives.
Peta, we know that Josh Healy has several generations of peace or activists in his family. What has inspired you to be so energized around this particular issue?
Well, I began organizing shortly after September 11th. The Answer Coalition was formed September 14th, 2001, and I joined September 15th, literally. Mm-hmm. And it's become something that's really meant a lot to me. Once I walked into that office, you know, I was immediately thrust into positions of leadership, and just the coalition, just I've received so much support from the coalition nationally that it became something that I got really involved in.
So
it wasn't so much my family support, it was the coalition.
So September 11th struck a chord in you?
Absolutely. I just felt that I had to organize against, you know, when you understand that there was so much racist repression of Muslim, Arab, Middle Eastern people, and that we were so obviously going to be manipulated into a war of aggression disguised as, you know, retribution for the attacks of September 11th, that I felt the only way that could be stopped, that it could be stopped, is by the people organizing. So I had to do something.
Peta Lindsay is a freshman at Howard University. She was joined by Sachin Aman, a freshman at Boston University, and Josh Healy, a freshman at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Big Labor got a treat this week when British singer-songwriter and activist Billy Bragg played to a packed crowd at the AFL-CIO headquarters here in Washington. They turned out to rally the vote to prevent the Senate from a Republican takeover in the upcoming national election. David Russo from the D.C. ND Media Center was there and prepared this mix.
Voices on the radio tell us that we're going to war. Those brave men and women in uniform, they want to know what they're fighting for.
With a really warm labor movement AFL-CIO welcome, British rock poet, recording star, Billy Bragg.
Thank you very much.
In the White House, they just don't give a damn. It's all about the price of oil. It's all about the price of oil.
Well, my concern on this trip really is to try and reflect something that we feel very, very strongly about in Great Britain and right across Europe. And I can really sum that up in saying that we have great empathy and deepest sympathy with the people of the United States of America. With regard to the events of September the 11th, the magnitude, the horror, the grief, we have nothing but sympathy for you. But that doesn't mean that we have to sign up to George W. Bush's remedy for that problem by
becoming involved in the Middle East. So
it's people you're after, then why have we waited so long? Why didn't we sort this out last time? Was he much evil then than he is now? The stock market holds the answer to why him, why here, why now? 'Cause it's all about the price of oil. It's all about the price of oil. Don't give me no...
We connect with one another across the ocean and around the world. That self-same media that we're always blaming for not giving you information
from around the world, the mainstream media that only chooses to reflect American news is actually a two-way wall, because it stops us hearing voices of dissent from inside the United States of America, and the McNews that passes for discourse in the mainstream media. And we need to make these connections, because we have a real problem at the moment, which is the anti-war movement in Europe as a very nasty vein of anti-Americanism in it. And we have to kind of, you know, sort of remember that, you know, it's not your fault. It's not as if you voted for this guy. I mean, you know, it's, you know, it's one of those. But enough irony already. We've got the joke. You can do something about it in the midterms, which would be great, because we have no control over this guy. You know, shit, we have no control over Tony Blair. Never mind that.
Once upon a time, both these evil men were supported by the USA. And whisper it, even Bin Laden once drank from America's cup. Just like that election down in Florida, this shit doesn't all add up. It's all about the price of oil. It's all about the price of oil. Don't give me no shit about blood, sweat, tears and toil. It's all about the price of oil.
You're president. We do need to make this connection between our countries, because a United States of America that becomes isolationist, that becomes unilateralist, is no help to any of us. We need you to sign up to the Kyoto Accords. We need you to sign up to the International Criminal Court. We need you to take a role. And what we need you to do is something that I think is unique in your tradition, and I think is one of the great American values. We need you to come into the world and take charge of what I think you'll call barn raising. That great American tradition where you come together as a community to help people build things that they're not capable of building themselves. That's the America that we need to come out in the 21st century. To say, yeah, we do have the power to do this. We do have the economy to do this. And we are going to come out and act responsibly with other people to make the world a better place. And our enemy in doing that, frighteningly, is not capitalism or conservatism, it's cynicism. We've got to overcome people's cynicism of the ability of nations to act together for good. And cynicism is what's making the vote go down. Cynicism is what's killing the turnout. Cynicism is what's letting the Rush Limbaughs of this world get away with what they're getting away with. So we're battling against cynicism. You know, we're battling in favor of participation, and we're battling against war.
I grew up in a company town, and I worked real hard till that company closed down. They gave my job to another man on half my wages in some foreign lands. And when I asked how could that be any good for our economy, I was told nobody cares so long as they make money when they sell their shares. Can you hear us? Are you listening?
British singer-songwriter Billy Bragg in concert this week at the AFL-CIO headquarters in Washington. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. When we come back, Daniel Ellsberg, a Bruderhof pastor who urges us to practice forgiveness over fear, and lots more.